This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll interview David Talbot, author of the new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government.
The conclusion of this book is forcefully argued, and that argument is that ultimately it was Alan Dulles who organized a coup d'etat that assassinated President John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
We'll speak with Rebecca Vilcomerson from Jewish Voices for Peace about what may be the beginning of a full-scale Palestinian uprising in Israel.
The major media in this country, principally the New York Times, has distorted what's going on there. We'll hear from Rebecca on what's really happening.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
As director of the CIA from 1952 until Kennedy fired him in 1963, Alan Dulles has been said to exemplify unbridled authority at the height of the Cold War. Under his leadership, the CIA became a paramilitary lawless force domestically and internationally that engaged with impunity in covert acts such as the assassination of foreign leaders, including Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala, and the overthrow of a number of foreign governments. As an attorney for the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell in New York City in the 1930s, Dulles protected and promoted Nazi-controlled cartels. He wielded his influence in the Office of Strategic Services during the Second World War and then in the CIA to shield former Nazis from prosecution for war crimes in the 1940s and 50s. David Talbot writes in his book, The Devil's Chessboard, over the final months of the JFK presidency, a clear consensus took shape within the American deep state. Kennedy was a national security threat. For the good of the country, he must be removed, and Dulles was the only man with the stature, connections, and decisive will to make something of this enormity happen. The Devil's Chessboard by David Talbot is a detailed examination of the dark career of Alan Dulles. David is the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon and the former senior editor at Mother Jones. David Talbot, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Let's talk about the beginnings of the Dulles family in America and a little bit about their ancestry.
Well, they are a family that's very much a part of what C. Wright Mills, the sociologist, later called the power elite in his famous book in the 1950s. And these were men, in the case of John Foster Dulles and his brother, Alan, or boys at the time, who were born to power. Their family were included two secretaries of state, lawyers, people who were quite comfortable, you know, running the country. And the boys literally sat at the knee of that power as they grew up. Not a particularly wealthy family. Their father was a very committed Presbyterian minister who would literally give you the coat off his back, as he did in the case of one poor parishioner. And he wasn't a terribly acquisitive man himself, their father. But nor were the brothers particularly in the case of Alan Dulles, but they were very concerned with power, how to accumulate it and how to manipulate it.
And they had that Calvinist streak and that belief in the exceptional quality of America, which I thought you wrote about so well. Talk a little bit about that, would you please?
Yeah, well, their father is a Presbyterian minister, and though he himself is a modest man and a progressive man in many ways, he does have a missionary streak, and the boys inherit that. Now, they're not particularly religious themselves, but their missionary streak involves American power and extending that power, that dominion, throughout the world. And so that's the kind of, I think, Calvinist or missionary streak that they inherit, Foster and Alan. You know, this became very much sort of the ideology, of course, of the 20th century, of Henry Luce, the the great press baron who founded the Time Life Empire. You know, he penned a famous piece during World War II that declared the American century and that it was America's right and in fact obligation, and he thought almost in religious terms too, to build this imperial dominion throughout the world, not in the old-fashioned sense where, you know, the great European powers would hold land and hold colonies, but to really extend our influence through military means, through intelligence, through corporate means, and cultural ideology.
If you will, tell us a bit about the brothers Wall Street law firm Sullivan and Cromwell and who some of their clients were.
So the Dulles brothers emerge in the power sphere really by taking over and running the most important and largest law firm on Wall Street, Sullivan and Cromwell. And this, you know, really is the leading law firm for the major corporate brands and financial institutions throughout America, and not just America, but globally. This is a global, you know, power nexus. So, in fact, some of its greatest fortune, Sullivan and Cromwell, comes from working with German clients emerging from World War I as Germany begins to rebuild after that devastating war. And a number of the major powers, corporate powers that they're dealing with as clients are companies that later become quite notorious during the Third Reich, the rise of Hitler, companies like IG Farben and Krupp Steel. IG Farben, of course, was the chemical conglomerate that manufactured, among other things, the pesticide Zyklon B that was used in the death camps to exterminate Jews. So they had no compunctions about dealing with companies like this well into Hitler's rise. And it was only under great pressure from within the law firm and that Foster Dulles, who is the chief counsel there, is finally forced to shut down their Berlin office and to begin to pull back somewhat from their connections to the German economy and the Nazi regime. Although those connections, as I write about in my book, continued in a covert way through World War II and into the post-war years.
And they helped Nazi war criminals escape justice. Talk about that, please.
Well, you know, Alan Dulles gets himself sent over to Switzerland during World War II as our top spy working for the OSS, which was the U.S. spy agency during World War II. He doesn't want to go to London, where he'll be under closer supervision. He wants to go to Switzerland. He has a history there. He's worked out of Switzerland before as a spy. He, as I say, has connections to German business interests. The Swiss banks, although Switzerland was ostensibly neutral during World War II, Swiss banks were operating basically as laundering mechanisms for Nazi loot. And he uses his perch in Switzerland, where he has very little immediate supervision from back home in Washington because he's so far away and because the Nazis have, of course, cut off Switzerland from the outside world. So he can do pretty much whatever he pleases. And what he goes about doing is trying to cut a separate deal with Nazi forces, and he finally succeeds in doing this with Karl Wolff, who is the SS commander, head of all security forces in Italy for the Nazis, in an operation called Operation Sunrise. Well, this was in direct defiance of President Roosevelt's policy of unconditional surrender. We're not going to deal with the Nazis. We're not going to cut a separate deal with them. We're going to crush this evil regime and bring its leaders to justice. Well, Dulles didn't get the memo, so to speak, and he was more intent on cutting deals with Nazis, including some high-level ones, representatives of Heinrich Himmler, the head of the SS, of all people, because he was more concerned about the Soviet Union coming after World War II and checking its power. And he thought that Germany, even a Germany that included former members of the Nazi regime, should be kept as a powerful bulwark against the Soviet Union. So he sets up these so-called Nazi rat lines, these escape routes that allowed Nazis to escape over the Alps, down through Italy, and then overseas. In fact, he even installs one of the more notorious Nazis, the Hitler spymaster on the bloody Eastern Front, a man named Reinhard Gehlen. He installs him after the war as the top spymaster in democratic post-war West Germany, a position that Gehlen holds throughout much of the Cold War, and forms a kind of sinister alliance between the CIA and this former Nazi.
The idea that Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles had was that they were on the defensive against an aggressive, expanding Soviet Union. I think that that notion kind of stands the truth on its head. And I wanted you to comment on their anti-communism.
Well, there's certainly no denying that Stalin was a monster to his own people, that millions perished under his despotic rule, and that is obviously a historical fact. It's undeniable. But what I try to show in this book is that the United States, during these Cold War years, was capable of great evil itself. And encountering the evil of Stalin, in some ways, our intelligence empire, our security empire under Allen Dulles went even further. So torture, mass surveillance of private citizens, extraordinary rendition, CIA black sites, human experimentation, mind control experimentation, political assassinations, all these things that Dulles ironically accused the Soviet Union of, his own agency was really in some ways pioneering in all these techniques long before 9/11. These were all techniques that the CIA under Allen Dulles was employing through the Cold War. So, yeah, I think we need to have a historical, a balanced historical look at what happened in those years, and not only acknowledge the evils that were committed by Stalin and other Soviet leaders, but also by our own leaders. And these were men who felt they were above the law, that democracy was something too important to be left in the hands of you and me and our elected representatives. This was, as C. Wright Mills called them, the power elite, or today many scholars refer to as the deep state. And the kind of forces that they represent are anathema, the secret forces of secrecy and permanent war. These are anathema to a healthy democracy.
David, let's talk about Allen Dulles' role at the beginning of the CIA.
Well, Allen Dulles is in some ways, although he's not the first director of the CIA, he's the father of the CIA. As soon as he comes back from World War II, he goes back to his Wall Street firm, Sullivan & Cromwell, but he continues to operate in the shadows in the intelligence world, and he's pushing right away for a powerful agency like the CIA, and it finally is signed into law in 1947 by President Harry Truman. Well, Harry Truman thought he was just creating basically an intelligence-gathering agency that could funnel the best information to the White House. But in fact, what Dulles and his allies build in the CIA is much more of a covert weapon, a weapon of violence, of secrecy. And in fact, Harry Truman later came to believe, and he wrote an op-ed piece, in fact, in the Washington Post after the Kennedy assassination, saying that in some ways the CIA had become a Frankenstein that was not only threatening democracies overseas, but threatening our own democracy at home. So this was a startling essay that the former president wrote. And that's exactly what Dulles and his cohorts had in mind. They thought that American power, basically the American empire, as American corporate power expands around the world, needed this covert cloak and dagger arm to go about doing sort of the dirty business that empires require.
Well, yeah, let's talk about some examples of that, David. The overthrow of the democratically elected government in Iran, the overthrow of the reform government of Jacobo Arbenz in Guatemala the year after, the assassination of Patrice Lumumba in the Congo. These were all things that Allen Dulles was behind, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Absolutely, and in each case, of course, the CIA and its allies promote an image of these leaders, popular elected leaders in these countries, Iran, the Congo, and Guatemala, as mortal threats to U.S. interests and as communist sympathizers or as out-and-out communists, all of which were untrue. And, of course, we see the same kind of demonizing of the enemy today during the War on Terror, often in the most extreme terms. But these, in fact, were nationalist leaders who were trying to uplift their country. They'd come to power through the popular will, and had posed threats of one sort or another, not to freedom and to the American way of life, but to American corporate interests and Western corporate interests, the oil industry interests in the case of Iran, agribusiness and United Fruit, which was a major power throughout Latin America in those years and happened to be represented by the Dulles brothers' law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell. And so when Arbenz, for instance, in Guatemala, and he's kind of the Kennedy of Guatemala, married to a wealthy wife. He's a glamorous couple, but they're very committed to uplifting the poor in that almost medieval country. And one of the key ways they did that was try to redistribute land that was not being used by United Fruit, which basically owned the country, this major U.S. agribusiness firm. And as soon as he starts to do that, of course, antagonize those U.S. corporate interests, his days are numbered, and he's overthrown in the CIA-sponsored coup. And then I tell the story of that. Even then, they wouldn't leave Arbenz and his family alone. They're forced into exile after this coup, and it begins this kind of tragedy that mirrors the tragedy of Guatemala itself, where the family can't find one country that will take it in. The U.S. State Department under Foster Dulles and the CIA are pressuring country after country not to give haven to the Arbenz family. His daughter kills herself. He's finally found in a bathtub in Mexico City, scalded to death. That's how he ends his life. The authorities called it a suicide, but his family to this day is convinced he was murdered. And the CIA, in fact, did maintain a death list in Guatemala of other oppositional political figures besides Arbenz, activists, union leaders, farm worker activists, many of whom were indeed eliminated during the terrible killing fields of Guatemala that went for years after the CIA coup there in 1954. So it's a trail of tears that Allen Dulles' CIA leaves behind throughout the world.
I wanted to turn our attention first to Cuba, David, and then on to the JFK assassination. You know, Che Guevara was in Guatemala in 1954. He went there to work as a doctor. He saw what the United States did to the Arbenz government, and he later wrote when he met Fidel Castro in Mexico soon thereafter, he said, "It didn't take much for me to be convinced that I should work towards overthrowing these kinds of undemocratic regimes and restore democracy in Latin America." And he signed on to go to Cuba with Fidel to overthrow the Batista dictatorship. And that brings me to my question about Cuba. What was Dulles's attitude towards the Cuban Revolution and Fidel Castro?
Well, again, he saw Fidel Castro, this charismatic nationalist who was wanting to establish sovereignty for his own nation, this country that was basically a colony of the U.S. and U.S. corporate interests for many years. And he saw that as a threat to companies like Standard Oil, to the big agribusiness firms that basically own that island. And immediately, or soon thereafter, after Fidel does take power, and by the way, you're right, that Fidel and Che Guevara both learned from the lesson of Guatemala that you can't basically, within that period, this Dulles, with the shadow of Allen Dulles and these hardline national security interests in the United States, that was virtually impossible for a Latin American country in those years to emerge from that colonial state without confronting American power in some way. And so what Fidel learned from and Che learned from Guatemala is that you have to arm your revolution, and you have to be prepared to militarize your revolution, and which is what they did. And that made them, of course, even more of a direct threat to these U.S. imperial interests there. So they quickly go about trying to undermine Castro. And in fact, while Castro was at a U.N. Meeting in 1960 in New York, he's forced to go up to Harlem because no hotel will take his delegation because the Eisenhower administration is pressuring, New York to basically give him a cold shoulder. But he's warmly welcomed at Hotel Teresa in Harlem, and it becomes an embarrassment to the Eisenhower administration, and world leaders are coming up to Harlem, and this is the beginning of the civil rights movement.
That's where Malcolm X had his office.
Yeah. That's right. Malcolm X comes to meet with Fidel in a famous meeting at the Hotel Teresa. Well, just blocks away at the Plaza Hotel, the CIA is meeting with the mafia. They're conspiring to kill Fidel. So, I mean, it really began there. And, Allen Dulles essentially created a very lethal killing team that went around the world enforcing the CIA's will, killing leaders, some of whom we know about, or targeting leaders, but also leaders that were under the radar, many of whom we don't know about, as I said earlier, union organizers, journalists, opposition political figures. And so this was a beast that we had unleashed around the world, in Africa, in Latin America. And it was a very, I think, ominous development for America itself and for American democracy to be running this kind of murder racket.
David, let's turn domestically. What was the origin of Dulles's hatred of JFK?
Well, you know, Dulles met young JFK when he was still a senator. He just recovered from back surgery when they first met at the Kennedy home in Palm Beach, Florida. He was very weak physically at that point. He seemed very young. And Dulles thought, this is the kind of guy I could take under my wing. There are many people in Congress who Dulles did, in fact, kind of mentor and manipulate in various ways. He was very close to Prescott Bush, the head of that dynasty, who Senator Prescott Bush from Connecticut was basically the CIA's man on Capitol Hill. So he thought, you know, here was another wealthy...
That was George Bush's father.
That's right, George H.W. Bush's father. And so he thought Kennedy was another, you know, wealthy young guy who's, you know, political ambitions, and he and his brother could kind of steer him in the right direction. But Kennedy kind of starts to break away, actually, from the Dulles Cold War ideology as senator. He speaks out against the French colonial war in Vietnam. He speaks out against the French colonial war in Algeria. He says that these rising third world countries have a right to their own destinies. And he says that's the correct path for America to take, not to stand in the way of history, but to actually allow these countries to find their own paths and their own destinies. Well, this is, you know, a direct affront, of course, to the Dulles worldview that these countries should be under our thumb in different ways. And so he starts to break away from the Dulles, you know, worldview then. But the real clash is when Kennedy becomes president. And he decides, I think, fatefully to keep Allen Dulles on as CIA director. He thinks he needs to show that kind of continuity because he's won the White House by such a slim margin. He keeps some figures from the Eisenhower era in his administration. But they lead him astray at the Bay of Pigs in April 1961. The CIA, you know, persuades him this is going to be a quiet and clean operation, that they can go in with this kind of motley brigade of 1,100 Cuban exiles and easily overthrow Fidel Castro. Well, of course, that was absurd, and Dulles, I believe, as I write in my book, knew that it was absurd all along, and the plan, his secret plan, was after this initial invasion bogged down, he thought he could then manipulate this young president into sending the full power of the U.S. military into Cuba and overthrowing Castro. Well, Kennedy shocks him by standing his ground and says, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to blow this up into an international incident. I'm not going to send in the U.S. military. And, of course, the invasion fails. And shortly thereafter, Kennedy, who's furious with Dulles for giving him wrong intelligence and basically trying to sandbag him, fires Dulles and his two top deputies. And Dulles, again, doesn't get the memo. This is consistent throughout his whole career, where he basically defies one president after the next. After being forced out by Kennedy in November 61, he goes home to Georgetown in Washington, and he proceeds to operate as if he's still running the CIA. He keeps meeting with his top deputies and field agents, including some very suspicious characters who will come up later in kind of a sinister way in our history. And he begins to essentially set up an anti-Kennedy government in exile.
Let me read to you, because I want to turn our attention in the final segment of our discussion to the assassination of JFK. And let me read to you a short paragraph that you wrote on that in the book. Over the final months of the JFK presidency, a clear consensus took shape within America's deep state. Kennedy was a national security threat. For the good of the country, he must be removed. And Dulles was the only man with the stature, connections, and decisive will to make something of this enormity happen. He had already assembled a killing machine to operate overseas. Now he prepared to bring it home to Dallas. All that his establishment colleagues had to do was to look the other way, as they always did when Dulles took executive action. Let's talk about the Kennedy assassination. I know that you believe Dulles had a central role in that, and I wanted you to talk to us about that, please.
Well, look, I think just the evidence, and admittedly, it's circumstantial. We don't have a confession from Dulles. We don't have a smoking gun. The CIA doesn't operate that way. This is a very secretive world. But I think the overwhelming circumstantial evidence does point to Alan Dulles' central involvement in the assassination and certainly the cover-up, because, of course, he served on the Warren Commission conveniently as well, the investigative body that looked into the assassination. But, you know, here's a man who does have this bitter falling out with the president, does think the president is weak, that he wants to be loved by the world instead of respected and feared. Alan Dulles said that in a speech in the final months of Kennedy's presidency. And this reflects this hatred of Kennedy as a weak president, as an appeaser, someone who's trying to make peace with Khrushchev in Russia and with Castro in Havana. This reflects not just his own feeling, but the circle of the power elite, as I say, this deep state, this group of men on Wall Street and in Washington who seem to, you know, go from one administration to the next, no matter who happens to be elected. You know, there was a growing feeling within this circle that Kennedy was an aberrant president by trying to end the Cold War. And you know, imagine if the president had come in at the height of the war on terror, like an Obama, instead of going along with the war in Afghanistan Iraq had begun to break from that kind of overwhelming, you know, reign of fear, and said, no, we can find a different way towards peace, a different path towards peace. There would have been, of course, an enormous backlash against a president like that today. And that's what was going on with Kennedy in the early 60s. And Dulles was the kind of executor of this group. He was the most well-connected. He had the connections on Wall Street. He had the connections in Washington, the national security world, and overseas, and in the Texas oil industry, who were his clients. He was kind of Dick Cheney on steroids. There was no more powerful figure in America in those days than Alan Dulles. But he would never have acted alone. He was acting in a way that represented the will of his group, his power group. And we know that, I know, as I say in the book, for the first time, we know that the person he put in charge of the CIA assassination team, who was in charge of the CIA mafia operation to kill Castro, a man, a very violent man named William Harvey, who Alan Dulles had put in charge of that killing team, he was spotted by his own deputy flying from Rome, where Harvey was stationed at the time, to Dallas in early November 1963, shortly before the assassination of the president. He had no official reason to be there. And in fact, he's one of a number of people who were connected to the Dulles assassination team who were indeed, by their own words or by the evidence of others, spotted in Dallas in November 1963.
And you haven't been able to get the travel vouchers from the CIA, have you?
That's right. So we could pin this down. You know, I believe that Harvey's deputy was a very credible source. He was a very respected CIA veteran. Mark Wyatt was his name. And he told his grown children the story, and he suspected Harvey was indeed deeply involved in the assassination of President Kennedy. But we could confirm his travel to Dallas if the CIA would release his travel vouchers, William Harvey's travel vouchers. I applied to the CIA under the Freedom of Information Act through my attorney for those records, and they refused to release them. In fact, the CIA to this day, in defiance of federal law, has refused to release over 1,100 key documents related to the Kennedy assassination. So what are they hiding 50 years later? The American people have a right to this history, and yet they continue to stonewall.
David, why do you say that the Warren Commission was really the Dulles Commission, and how was the assassination covered up?
Well, of course, immediately after the arrest of Lee Harvey Oswald and then, of course, his convenient assassination, and by the way, Bobby Kennedy, the Attorney General, who was an expert on organized crime, he'd come, in fact, his career was made as a top investigator into organized crime, working with the Senate Rackets Committee in the 1950s. Bobby Kennedy, as I've documented, immediately when he looked into Jack Ruby's shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald in the basement of the Dallas police station, immediately figured out that Jack Ruby was essentially a mafia errand boy. So we know that the CIA was already working with the mafia to kill Castro, that they used the mafia to do its dirty work, and I believe it's clear, and Bobby Kennedy figured this out right away, that Jack Ruby was used to silence Oswald because he knew too much. I believe that they were very fearful that if Oswald had lived, he would begin to pull up the strings of this plot. I believe that he was a patsy, just as he shouted out to the press in the Dallas police station, Oswald. And I believe he thought he was playing some sort of low-level intelligence role. His mother, Marguerite, told the press that. And I think what the biggest fears that Allen Dulles and the CIA had was that if there was a true investigation into this crime, the sort of intelligence connections to Oswald, tying Oswald to agencies like the CIA, would begin to come out. You know, Senator Richard Schweiker, who did one of the first legitimate investigations into Dallas when he was on the Church Committee in the 1970s, he said, when you look at Lee Harvey Oswald, you see the fingerprints of intelligence all over him. And that's what Dulles, when he was on the Warren Commission, was determined not to come out. So you see, again and again, how Dulles misdirected the commission, pointed them in every direction other than to look at the possible connections between Oswald and the intelligence establishment.
David Talbot is the author of an extremely important new book called The Devil's Chessboard, Allen Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. David, is it fair to say that Allen Dulles was not a deviant, but was really accomplishing the goals of the American establishment, and that he laid the foundation for the kind of state that we're living in now?
Well, exactly, and thank you for saying my book's important, and that's exactly why I think the book is important. This isn't just history that doesn't matter today. This is history that has direct relevance on what America is going through today. We are involved in an epic struggle between democracy and secret government, and Ed Snowden made this very clear for all of America to see. And, you know, we have to decide as American citizens, are we living in a true democracy, or have we basically subcontracted our freedom to the secretive agencies that run the country and keep us at war year after year after year, and that invade our privacy and subvert our civil liberties? So this is the kind of legacy that we inherited from Allen Dulles. It continues in spades during the War on Terror. Allen Dulles could only have dreamed of some of the Orwellian Big Brother technology that the CIA and the NSA and these other multiple agencies have at their disposal today. So we need to confront this, and it's not being debated in the presidential campaign today, but American citizens have to make it a national priority.
How did you get political? How did you figure all this out?
You know, I grew up in a political family, but in some ways my dad was an old movie actor. He was one of the founders of the Screen Actors Guild.
Oh.
But he was a conservative guy when I was growing up. But then under our influence, I think, you know, he started shifting left from Goldwater, literally, to McGovern.
Wow.
But so it was always a political house that way. And then, of course, I was, it was the Vietnam War, my generation, your generation, I'm sure. And that's what really, I think, politicized me. In a way, though, then I had this liberal lefty career as a journalist, Mother Jones and so on, starting Salon. But even when I was at Salon, I would say I've become a little more radical since then. You know, it was actually doing the research on not this book, but my earlier book, Brothers, about the Kennedy brothers.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just so mind-blowing what I was, you know, finding out. It just became so clear that how we'd lost our democracy, and it just enraged me, you know. So, like all of us, we were raised to believe in these things, and then to see them, I think I was re-radicalized. You know, I was radical as a kid, and this research kind of re-radicalized me.
David Talbot, author of The Devil's Chessboard, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
David, you've really provided a real public service. It's a tour de force. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Heidi. All right. Thank you.
Thanks, David. Bye-bye.
Thank you, David.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
soon as you're born. They make you feel small. By giving you no time, instead of it all, but we cannot function, we can feel nothing at all. They hurt us at home, they beat us at school. Hate us when we're clever, despise us when we're fools. Yeah, they got us so fucking crazy, we cannot follow their rules. Working class hero is something.
This past October, more than 49 Palestinians were shot dead by Israeli occupation forces, while 500 others were wounded by live ammunition and even thousands more otherwise injured. As a mass popular rebellion, often attracting tens of thousands of Palestinians, asserts its right to self-determination and freedom, Israel has escalated a brutal response, especially in occupied East Jerusalem. The Palestinian Boycott, Divest, Sanction National Committee, a diverse coalition of Palestinian unions and organizations which leads the global BDS movement, recently called for a wave of solidarity with Palestinian popular resistance and to pressure governments, institutions, and businesses to end their support for Israel's violations of international law. Tens of thousands of people across 100 cities took to the streets to show Israel that it will be held to account for its crimes. Despite this mass outpouring, mainstream media coverage remains, for the most part, extremely biased, echoing Israel's propaganda. Here to discuss the uprising is Rebecca Vilcommerson, Executive Director of Jewish Voices for Peace. JVP is a national grassroots organization rooted in Jewish tradition, human rights, and international law that works for a just peace, self-determination, and full equality for all people of Palestine and Israel. Rebecca, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
A spontaneous uprising of a new generation of Palestinians, which some people have called the Jerusalem Intifada, is occurring. What are its causes?
I think there's many, many causes. I think the most important thing to keep in mind is that for Palestinians, this current situation is simply unsustainable, and it's now reaching a breaking point. And it's really been decades of dispossession and state violence and oppression that has led to this moment. And also, I think, a real lack of sense of hope and a feeling of some degree of desperation. And so I think this is really an uprising. There's a sense of finally we're doing something to resist the ongoing oppression that we deal with every day. And, you know, the way we are receiving it in the mainstream media has been very much that there's an upsurge in violence, and that's because Israelis are being attacked. And, of course, you know, attacks on civilians are really not justifiable, but I think it's so important to understand the root causes, which is just this, you know, really decades of oppression and ongoing oppression that's happening to Palestinians all the time. And so for them, this is not an upsurge. This is the number of Palestinians who have been killed in October, of course, is enormous, but Palestinians are being killed all the time, all year long. And there's been, you know, certain times when there's more than that. But apart from the deaths, the systems of oppression that they live under are simply unbearable. And I think at the end, that is the root cause of this uprising.
Well, Netanyahu came to power for the second time in 2009. And would you say that right-wing extremism has accelerated since then?
I think the right-wing extremism doesn't come from Netanyahu himself. I mean, he is obviously, he's engaged in enormous amounts of incitement of the population, as have many cabinet members. And the cabinet now has members that represent positions that used to be fringe and are now moving into the mainstream, and that's very frightening. But I do think that the Israeli government is a true reflection of where Israeli society is. So I think, you know, they work in tandem, of course, but the reality is that Netanyahu is a reflection of where people are in Israel, not that he is bringing people more to the right. And I think, to be honest, the next prime minister will probably be more to the right, if that can be imagined, than Netanyahu himself is.
Hard to imagine. How many Jewish settlers have moved into the West Bank since 2009?
I don't know the exact number since 2009. I know it's now well over 500,000 total. So, of course, the number has increased steadily ever since the 1967 war. And I think it's very important to note that that has been true, whether the government has been a Labor government or a Likud government. So this is something that has been Israeli government policy, regardless of who is running the government, and is really a reflection of Israeli policy of what I think we should now consider annexation as opposed to occupation. It's a permanent occupation. It's not the word occupation by itself does not reflect the reality on the ground, which is that of the level of control that Israel has taken over the lands that were conquered in 1967.
Rebecca, can you tell us some of the discriminatory laws that target Palestinian citizens of Israel?
Yeah, Palestinian citizens of Israel in general live as second-class citizens. Of course, the whole foundation of the state is as a Jewish state. So as 20% of the population, they are not part of the nationality of the state. And that's reflected even in ID cards. So people who are Jewish are, you know, are identified as having Jewish nationality, and those who are not, and that makes a difference in every way. The organization Adala, which is a wonderful civil rights organization in Israel, has documented 50 different laws that create unequal conditions for Palestinian citizens of Israel. Of course, the most important one is that Jews anywhere in the world can come and settle in Israel and, in fact, receive money to do so, while Palestinians, who even those who have a very direct connection to Israel, that whether their parents or their other relatives live there, cannot immigrate to the country. But within that, funding for education is completely separate. There are separate school systems for Palestinian citizens of Israel than from Jewish students, and Palestinian schools get much less funding than Jewish ones do. There's discriminatory housing, so Palestinian citizens can't get permits to expand either their individual homes or to expand their villages. There's almost, except for in the big cities, there's almost complete segregation of Palestinian and Jewish Israeli villages and towns. And because Palestinian citizens of Israel don't serve in the army, which is part of Israeli policy, with some exceptions, some Bedouin Israelis can volunteer for the army, some Druze can volunteer for the army, but if you haven't served in the army the way many of the laws are framed, then you can't get a series of benefits that others do. And so that means that Palestinian citizens are excluded from a lot of benefits that Jewish Israelis receive. And then, of course, the overall land ownership is very different in that the Jewish National Fund owns 93% of the land in Israel, and so there's very little Palestinian control over the land. And then there's the series of new laws that have been passed, including that of the Nakba law, which prohibits Palestinian students from being taught about the Nakba in school.
And you have to explain what the Nakba is for some of our listeners.
Sure. The Nakba is the Palestinian word for catastrophe. So in 1948 and before, when Israel was being founded, about 700,000 Palestinians were dispossessed of their lands and their homes and their villages and became refugees, and that's what Palestinians refer to as the Nakba. So the Nakba is part of Palestinian history in the same way that being a refugee from Hitler's Germany is part of some Jews' histories, and that is no longer considered legal to teach in Palestinian schools.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, what about the other law, the boycott law? Tell us about what that is.
The new boycott law, you mean the one that's just passing through the Knesset?
Yes.
So there's two boycott laws. There's a law that's already passed that says that any person inside of Israel, citizen of Israel, who supports any form of boycott can be liable for financial damages. No one has yet been sued under the statute, but it's had an enormous chilling effect on Israeli citizens who do actually support boycott as a nonviolent way to put pressure on the Israeli government to change their policies. So that's had a real chilling effect for activists inside of Israel. The new law, which was just recently introduced, is currently working its way through the Knesset. It just passed its key committee, and it says that anyone who supports any form of boycott who is not an Israeli citizen will not be allowed to enter Israel any longer. So, you know, it's unclear how they would enforce that law, but it does mean that those of us who, you know, like me, for example, my husband is Israeli, my children have Israeli citizenship, my grandparents are buried there, I would no longer be able to enter the country if this law is passed. And I do want to note that that is something that, you know, those of us who support BDS politically will now feel, but it has been true for a long time for Palestinian Americans who have often tried to get into Israel to visit family who lives either in the West Bank or in Israel itself, and who often get turned away at the border. So it's been already a long time that Israel has selectively allowed Americans into Israel, and it's been a question of racial profiling. This will be a question of political profiling. And I think that's also, you know, one more thing to note about the situation that Palestinian citizens of Israel live in is that they are generally targeted for much more repression, even than Jewish Israeli leftists are, much more so. So, for example, just last month, somebody, a Palestinian citizen of Israel, was arrested for something he had posted on Facebook supporting what was happening in the uprising. Palestinian citizens of Israel are arrested and harassed by Israeli security forces at a quite astonishing rate. So I think the sort of various different approaches to repressing political speech are accelerating.
We're speaking with Rebecca Vilcomerson, the head of Jewish Voices for Peace. Rebecca, you mentioned BDS, but I think we should talk about what BDS stands for.
So BDS stands for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction. And the call to do for Boycott, Divestment, and Sanction, or BDS, came from Palestinian civil society in 2005. So at this point, the vast majority of Palestinian civil society now is asking globally for people to support Palestinian rights by boycotting, divesting, and sanctioning Israel. So, you know, boycotting is obviously consumer products. Divesting can be divesting from investment funds, and sanctioning would be a government action penalizing Israel for its policies. And the three demands of the boycott, divestment, and sanction call are an end to the occupation, full equality for Palestinian citizens of Israel, and the right of return for Palestinian refugees around the world.
What is the strategy behind this persistent Israeli violence, the escalation of violence? Do you think it's to totally ethnically cleanse and Judaicize all of East Jerusalem?
It's an excellent question. You know, there's a famous quote, I don't remember who said it, but it was some Israeli officer who said, "We don't do Gandhi very well." And I think that, you know, that's quite telling. You know, I think, you know, obviously Israel has the overwhelming military advantage. I mean, even to call it it's not even comparable. You know,
it's not a conflict, really.
It's not comparable to compare Palestinians with stones and knives and the occasional homemade rocket with, you know, the kind of military that Israel has. But Israel is very, very comfortable in a violent for that reason, I think, in a violent conflict with Palestinians, and they're able in that way to promote an image of Israel as the victim. And I think they've been doing a very good job of that with the help of the American media, I must say. The New York Times, I think, has done a pretty terrible job of not talking at all about the root causes of this uprising and acting like Israelis are being knifed in the streets out of pure hatred without explaining the levels of the kind of ongoing repression that Palestinians face. So, you know, I think that the Israeli government is becoming, like you noted, more and more right-wing. There is a clear goal of Judaizing certainly East Jerusalem. The Israeli government has talked forever about Jerusalem being the capital of Israel. So I do think it is both a cause and a goal of this current moment to solidify the control over Jerusalem and also over the West Bank.
Rebecca, how would you characterize the Israeli judiciary? Some say it's a rubber stamp for the violent racism and dehumanization of Palestinians that has taken over Israeli society.
You know, it's really interesting. I'm in touch a lot with a lot of Israeli human rights lawyers, and it's a constant question that they are debating all the time. I don't know a lot about the ins and outs of the judiciary. I know that it's still considered to be one of the more liberal institutions in Israeli society, but I think that's a relative question. And I think just like here, you know, the courts are a reflection of society. So you're not going to have, the courts are not going to save Israel from itself. And I think it's becoming more and more conservative. And I think that the human rights lawyers in Israel are constantly debating with themselves about when it will stop making sense to go to the Supreme Court at all, and whether it is, you know, it is to a certain extent a rubber stamp on Israeli policies and gives a veneer of democracy to Israeli policies, a democracy and protection. At the same time, it's very hard, I think, to tell individual clients whose only recourse is the Supreme Court, even if they only win, you know, 0.1% of the time, the possibility of getting recourse is serious enough that it's hard to make that move. But my guess is, and I'm not saying this based on any particular knowledge of the conversations that are happening now, but my guess is that eventually, you know, there will have to be some sort of boycott, essentially, of the Supreme Court by human rights lawyers if there's a sense that there's no way to get any justice whatsoever there.
Rebecca, would you agree with Omar Barghouti, who says that the Palestinian Authority that came out of the Oslo process, he says the Palestinian Authority is, quote, a subcontractor of the Israeli occupation, end quote. And he says that the Oslo process is a fraud and that it's allowed the Israeli economy to establish economic ties and trade with China and India and Brazil, and that's what's boosting its fortunes. But he basically thinks that the Oslo process was not aimed at allowing Palestinians to develop their own state. And how would you characterize it?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I have to agree with that. I mean, I think, you know, obviously some people like Edward Said were very prescient in predicting that from the very beginning. Most other people had hope in the Oslo process, and it's easier now in retrospect to see all the problems of that process. But I think there's no doubt that now the PA, the Palestinian Authority, acts as subcontractors for the Israeli government. Essentially, the PA is enforcing Israeli policies. They are the ones who are repressing the large-scale demonstrations in the West Bank, and Palestinian Authority leaders, you know, enjoy a level of like sort of live in a little bubble in Ramallah, and because of that are unwilling, you know, at least in some part because of that, are unwilling to let go of their power or control or to give up, you know. And I think, you know, Abbas semi-threatened at the UN this year to dissolve the PA's security cooperation with Israel, but no moves have been made to done that. And that's really the moment that I think people both fear and hope for, depending on what your perspective is, about when that, you know, what will happen if that should happen. And it may very well turn into an incredibly violent civil war. But I think there are many Palestinians who feel that they're being repressed by the, you know, who obviously hold Israel accountable for the entire system, but feel that their direct oppressor is the Palestinian Authority and their level of cooperation with Israel.
What has been the role of young Palestinian women in the recent uprising?
You know, I haven't been there during this time. Certainly young people overall have been the driving force, or in some ways the only force leading this uprising, and that's been true of all of it was also true during the first Intifada and the second Intifada, that young people were on the front lines. And I can't say I know very much about the role of women specifically in this Intifada, except for to say, as part of this young generation, that's the generation that's really rising up spontaneously. You know, it seems like so far very much spontaneously.
So, Rebecca, how do you think, how do you hope that the violence will be ended?
It depends how you define ended. I mean, I think that the kind of terror that Palestinians feel now, leaving their homes, for example, in East Jerusalem, Palestinian workers can't get to their jobs. Palestinian citizens of Israel are afraid. Arab Jews in Israel have been mistaken for Palestinians. You know, there's been a real unveiling of the kind of racism within Israeli Jewish Israeli society, because of some of the attacks that have been made on Mizrahi Jews, which are Jews of, you know, Jews from Arab countries, who have been mistaken for Palestinians in these sort of mob mentality moments. So I think that this particular moment is very, very scary, and for Israelis too, to a much lesser extent than what Palestinians are living with, but also Israelis are living in fear walking the streets, and I think that kind of fear is obviously terrible, and it's not something anyone wants to go on. But I do think that one of the worst things that could happen is that there could be some sort of quiet, in quotes, that's imposed. That means that, you know, Israel manages to pacify through force the current Palestinian uprising, but none of the root causes of the reasons for the uprising get resolved. And there's no way that this, you know, maybe they'll be quiet for a few months or another year, but there's absolutely no way that the status quo can stand forever, given the level of, again, of occupation, dispossession, and state violence. So ultimately, I think the resistance won't end until the government stops brutally oppressing Palestinians so that they can live with freedom and equality. And until that moment happens, I don't think we can, you know, we can't expect or ask Palestinians to accept the current way that they're living, which is, you know, without any kind of freedom.
Thank you so much, Rebecca Vilcomerson. But before we say goodbye to you, tell us, how can people get in touch with Jewish Voices for Peace?
Thank you for asking. Jewish Voice for Peace is on the web, jvp.org. And we're also on Twitter at JVPLive. Those are probably the best two ways to start to become connected with us. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. Bye.
Take it easy.
Thank you.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.